Hello from Brooklyn. I'm Brendan Hart, and welcome to Super Cities, a no BS deep dive conversation about the people and trends moving cities forward. All views expressed are my own and do not reflect our sponsors or partners. Let's get into it. On this episode of Super Cities, we do a deep dive with Caroline Whistler, founder and CEO of Third Sector, a company working to accelerate the transition to a performance-driven social sector. We cover innovation in government, growing a social impact organization, and how to use data to improve cities. Caroline co-founded Third Sector after completing a Fulbright Fellowship in Brazil researching nonprofit sustainability. She's a graduate of Duke University. Let's hear from Caroline. So we'd like to start with some context. Tell us a little bit about your path to co-founding Third Sector.
Thanks for that question. So my first job out of graduating from school was actually as an AmeriCorps member with a community development financial institution called Nonprofit Finance Fund based in Boston. And my role there was a little bit different. I was partnering with an entrepreneur by the name of George Overholzer to try to help nonprofits to get growth capital, which many people think of as being a for-profit concept of equity, but I was really working with the nonprofit sector to try to help them get large infusions of operating capital to help them grow their impactful programs. And through that work, we realized, well, whether you're nonprofit or for-profit, you need to have a revenue model. And for nonprofits, those revenue models could be philanthropy, earned revenue, or government funding. And through our work trying to help impact-driven nonprofits raise primarily philanthropy to grow, we realized that there was a very large player of those three and that government was spending about $1 trillion a year, every year, on social services programs. But many of these impact-driven nonprofits didn't want to partner with governments because the funding was too compliance-driven, it was too hard to win those contracts, and they perceived that it would be too much of a burden to work with that group. And so, you know, you have the conversation once and it's interesting. You have the conversation 6, 7, 10, 12 times with different impact-driven nonprofits that are moving the needle for their communities and looking to scale. And you start to say, huh, you know, how could we think about getting government in the game for being able to identify impactful organizations and to also invest in scaling up solutions that work, and also to be a partner in helping communities define and find other solutions that move the needle on results for their constituents. And so we started Third Sector almost 8 years ago at this point, really to solve that problem. How can we help government transform and change how our taxpayer dollars are meeting communities, partnering with service providers and partnering with those communities in order to improve lives?
That's great. And so Third Sector's mission is to accelerate the transition to a performance-driven social sector. Two questions here. How does the organization accomplish that mission? And also, can you sort of break apart the mission statement a bit? How are you all thinking about or using the term performance-driven? What sort of specifically does the social sector mean as it relates to your work?
So to start with, actually, I'll start with the second part of your question, which is how do we really break it down? What are we accelerating towards? I'll start with the social sector piece. What we realized through this work, though we have our origins in the nonprofit sector, is that the social sector is really the different systems and the combination of systems focused on social change and social impact. And so as we think about the social sector more broadly, it's really made up of different systems, whether that's the public sector, private sector, and the nonprofit sector coming together to drive social impact. So as we think about the social sector more broadly, it's really about those different partnerships. And as we think about performance-driven, I'm really glad that you asked that question because I think that that's something that's evolved over time for us.
really, when we started our work, we wanted to help communities move and governments move as our strategy from funding inputs and paying for services to really shifting how government does business to be in the business of purchasing outcomes. And so for us, that's really what performance-driven means, to move from a system that pays for inputs and into a system that rewards outcomes and progress towards measurable improvements in people's lives. Now, I think the piece of evolution that we're in the middle of and really excited about right now is who determines what performance looks like and who determines what those metrics and outcomes look like. And I think that part of our strategy and what we're very excited about in implementing our mission and how we do our work and partnering with governments to look at their procurement processes and look at their contracting processes to start asking the question, how can we move from inputs to outcomes? I think the other piece that we've started to work on with communities is asking the question of who decides what outcomes are meaningful and how can we involve the community, the end beneficiaries, as well as the service providers who are executing on the contract government provides to really help define and decide what metrics and outcomes really show progress and performance for communities. And so that's an evolution that we're in the middle of with our work right now, but is something that is critical to the implementation of our mission and our strategy.
Can we talk a little bit about this point? I'm always interested and in some ways encouraged by the idea that the people involved in the social sector, involved in government and nonprofit in the nonprofit community and the folks who are trying to sort of move society forward tend to be good people who are reasonable. But the challenges, as I think you mentioned earlier, tend to be system based, right? The sort of system grows and in some ways calcifies over time. And so you end up with a fairly rigid way of, for instance, buying, right? Or procuring a service. It's not the individual within the system's problem. That person understands the mechanisms, but it tends to be a system-based problem. Mm-hmm. How do you all think about that, especially if you're working at a local level, right? Each municipality has its own system, its own way of buying, its own vocabulary around the system. What's the way to sort of approach that problem set?
Yeah, so I very much appreciate that question and absolutely agree that these are systemic issues for how we fund communities and we need to disrupt that. And so our strategy and really our way of doing that is meeting the particular community where they're at. Oftentimes we come in where a problem has already been identified politically within the system, whether that's homelessness, for example, where a city or a county might realize that they're increasing their spending on homeless services, and also they're watching an increase in chronic homeless individuals, right? Or they're increasing their funding for young people who are disconnected from education, and they're seeing that their roles are increasing in prison or in the child welfare system for those young people. And so I think that really the opportunity and why third sector exists now versus 30, 40, 50 years ago is that with all of the advances in data and technology, communities are starting to understand on a quantitative level as well as a qualitative level that they're not making progress on the major social problems in this country and that the resources that they're spending are being ineffective. And so first there needs to be, in order for third sector to come in and to have a starting point, there has to be sort of that acknowledgement of a problem where, the definition of crazy is doing the same thing year in and year out and expecting different results. And now they've got the data to show, wow, we really are not seeing results for this funding. So it's helpful to have that baseline. I think the other thing that's helpful when it's a very systems-based problem, for us, the strategy we've taken is, okay, a big part of that system is procurement and spending every year. And those contracts do come up for rebidding. And there is absolutely a calcified process and just a rigid way of how that's done. But it also
presents an opportunity when those contracts are rebid to partner with a community around a specific problem to rethink how that process could actually start to unfreeze some of the calcified bits of the system. And so to follow up on the homeless example, which we worked on in Santa Clara, they noticed this problem. They wanted to move to better health and better housing outcomes for chronic homeless individuals in their county. And so they decided, actually, in this case, to create a new procurement and say, hey, is there a way that we could use the procurement process and some of our resources to shift the conversation from one that's all about, oh, we need more blankets, we need more pillows, we need more shelter beds, to one that says, wait, we need more months of housing stability. We need folks to be able to get off the streets and stabilize in housing, and we need them to be healthier because of that, and reducing their involvement in justice and shelter systems. And so it started as a pilot project or a use case, as it often does. But again, using that power of contracting and procurement, we were able to disrupt the sort of normal way of doing business and partner with the county, whether it's their director of homeless services, some of their legal staff, their contract monitoring compliance staff, to think about a new way, a new demonstration of a different way to do business. And then once that project was launched and they saw, actually, they had some incredible success increasing months of stable housing, as well as reducing emergency room involvement with a very high user population, they were able to take some of those concepts and skills and think about embedding them further in the procurement system and adapting them to other programs overall. So I think, you know, as you're tackling the systems base, getting consensus around the problem that you're trying to solve, and then also providing a very clear use case that is a discrete demonstration project, but with connections back to influence the other larger parts of the system. In our case, it's the procurement and funding system and how priorities and outcomes are decided. Having that combination is really helpful to making some initial steps on that system side.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Can we unbundle the homelessness example a bit? Seems to be homelessness is one of these challenges that perpetuates, I believe, in some degree because it's such a complex social challenge, right? And includes a large number of stakeholders. So in this example, who's involved? When you say we, is it the local government plus a variety of nonprofits? Is it a number of agencies within the local government plus a variety of partners? How do you sort of think about stakeholder mapping this type of social challenge?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question, and it looks a little bit different in every community, but you do have to do that stakeholder mapping work. And in the case of Santa Clara, really the main stakeholder was actually the county and multiple agencies within the county, because the county for the first time was able to see that they were making investments and procuring for services outside of their homeless services agency while they were seeing increases in expenditures to their Medicaid and medical hospital system, which the county also ran, where they were seeing increased expenses in their justice system. And those were several of the systems that were involved. And then, you know, that all rolls up to the central budget office and the chief operating officer that's like, wait a minute, we're paying for the same folks many, many times over, and they don't have good life outcomes, right? And so really the main stakeholder that we started with was the county, who was recognizing this problem that was both a fiscal problem and cutting across their agencies. And then they also validated it with the community. So there were several community stakeholder groups, a group named Destination Home that had organized service providers and community members around this problem, which validated that, yes, it was a cross-sector problem and the county was the largest investor, whether it was from health, justice, or shelter services. And then also the service provider community. So the county engaged with over 100 service providers in the community about this process, this idea, and whether or not if the county were to move towards in issuing a new contract that rewarded housing stability, if that would be something that would be helpful to incentivize some alignment and progress across these systems. And what they found through those feedback sessions is that, yes, it would be helpful, but the county is going to have to include as part of the contract, you know, more than beds and pillows, but also the combination of housing support and flexible funding for housing in a very expensive housing market. They'd also need to include and align Medi-Cal funding with whichever service provider that they chose. So there could be some cost coverage for the health-related costs that would be billable. And they'd also need some flexible funding because a lot of times service providers do not get compensated to do what it takes to help somebody get into housing. They don't get compensated to pay for the bed or for the essentials that a person might need as they transition off the streets. And so really it was about, there was great support to move towards the outcome of increased of housing placement and housing stability for a very frequent user population that they actually identified, the top few hundred folks who were cycling in and out of the ER, of jail, and of shelter. But there was also this acknowledgement from the stakeholders that this couldn't be a one agency fix. The procurement needed to also align resources across housing, across health, and provide whichever service provider who was going to win the contract with the flexibility, the accountability towards the outcomes, but the flexibility to do what it takes, and more of a ongoing relationship as well with the county around the data and around how the success of the program was progressing during the contract period, which is over 6 years as opposed to 1 or 2 years, versus kind of having it be a black box and not knowing how you're doing and then being expected to deliver on certain results. So that was a little bit more of the process there. Looks different in every community, but that was how Santa Clara approached this particular problem and procurement.
Interesting. And can you talk to me a little bit about the importance of data in the social sector? It feels like one of these sort of red herring arguments is that government is somehow sort of intentionally inefficient or lacks accountability. But in my experience, at least, oftentimes it could just be traced to the information that's collected, how that information's aggregated and distributed to the to partners, and how accountability is tracked. Are you seeing sort of a pretty significant improvement in how the social sector is thinking about managing and leveraging data?
I think it's a really great question, and I'm smiling because I think I am seeing an improvement in government and the social sector overall recognizing the importance of data. That's definitely happened. But I think what I am also encouraged by is that folks in our communities are asking, so what? Why are we collecting this data? What does it matter? Are people actually better off because we collected that data? Did it influence how resources were allocated in the community? And how are we deciding what data is important to collect and providing, instead of, you know, historically and in many ways today, a lot of the data that has been collected is for compliance-driven reasons.
Right.
It's, oh, I need to prove to my funder that I served X many people, or I won't get the next grant, or I need to prove that I checked these boxes. Otherwise, I'm not going to get my contract renewed with the city or the county. So very compliance-driven data metrics. And I think that what I'm encouraged by is that, you know, with some of the work that we're doing to say, okay, what if data wasn't just for that report at the end of the year to say you checked a box or not, but what if you could actually use data for learning and improvement as to whether or not you're improving lives for those in your community? What would that mean for the type of data that we need to collect? What would that mean for the metrics that we currently have? And are they still useful? And in what ways are they useful? And what would it mean for the information that maybe we're not collecting today, but maybe as part of the next procurements, we should set up structures
to collect that information, because that's what's most important to end beneficiaries on the ground or to providers, to be able to show and measure progress towards, in many cases, which is what a lot of communities are searching for, is to help vulnerable populations thrive, like to help people reach their full potential. And, you know, another example that we work, that we worked with that speaks to this data issue is in Colorado with a workforce development example. Workforce has a lot of data to say, and it's been, people would say it's been performance driven for some time, which it has been. But the data and the performance that really a lot of the public workforce system has been supportive of is job placement and job retention, which are great, I would say, great metrics to measure, you know, to show whether or not somebody has a job and if they've kept it. They're less great measures if you're trying to understand whether or not that job can sustain a family and have a wage that actually covers the costs for a particular community. Those are less informative to know whether or not that job actually has a career pathway where somebody could grow over time and build a career that might sustain, you know, some of the automation and big things that we've got coming down the pike. And so our project in Colorado both looked at that data and looked at their program in workforce, which was a subsidized employment program with the goal of getting people placed into jobs and sustained into jobs. And Colorado was crushing it. They were doing a really great job on taking folks that were on their TANF welfare program, placing them through unsubsidized employment into unsubsidized jobs. Great. They were knocking it out of the park from that data point and from that compliance perspective. But as they use their data to look deeper and see, you know, what were the wages for those jobs that they were being placed into, they realized a couple of things. They realized that, one, most of the people going through the unsubsidized employment program, over 70%, were young families. So these were 3-4-person households, at least. And then they also realized, as they looked at the wages for the placement in unsubsidized employment, which they were doing really well at, that those wages were barely at minimum wage and not enough to sustain a family. And so that caused, you know, and they validated this with community members and with service providers that, yeah, we really are doing a rockin' job placing people into jobs, but they're not able to survive and thrive with those jobs. So that knowledge, what do you do with that in the public sector?
Right.
And because as we partnered with Colorado, they were able to both take that data and then say, huh, how can we then use that feedback to change our procurement, to change our contracting system, to incentivize the providers and communities, not just to place people into unsubsidized jobs, although that's really important and a critical step, but also give providers the flexibility to allow people to come back into the program and receive additional training with the goal of getting to a higher wage job. So for Colorado, they actually changed their program model and changed their procurement and provided some bonus payments and rewards for providers who go above and beyond the placement and retention piece to actually increasing the wages for individuals that participated in the program. And they allowed those individuals flexibility to come back and receive additional unsubsidized training and support in order to get to that next level. So that's one place that gives me hope on the data.
It seems like a really sort of central element of driving progress in the sector. Can we talk just a bit about the third sector? So I think you have offices in San Francisco and Boston. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And so you're disrupting the social sector. What does scale look like? I mean, presumably this sounds like an everywhere problem, which is a bit difficult to sort of appreciate for purposes of scale. But what is the glide path for third sector and by extension the social sector look like in say 2 years or 5 years?
Great. Well, I'm grateful for this question. I'm grateful that we've survived long enough for you to ask the question, what does scale look like?
You're doing something. Yeah.
Disrupting. Yeah. So we've been privileged to be doing this work for as long as we have. And a lot of the work we've done over the past 8 years is just showing that demonstration projects and use cases like the Colorado example I shared and the example with homelessness in Santa Clara are possible. So that was the past 8 years. Can you transform a contract as a use case? And so that was great. And we're excited by that. I think for us, scale over the next 2 to 5 years, we are focusing on a couple of things. We need to show that this is a viable way for government to do business. And that means moving beyond one contract within a jurisdiction or an agency to working with an entire agency and all of their contract groupings, or working with an entire funding stream and the many relationships or contracts that an agency might have with that, working across agencies within a jurisdiction. So we're deeply excited to go deeper in place and to move beyond, in many cases, the same communities that have done a demonstration project with one contract are also excited about doing larger work at an agency level. So we're been excited by Los Angeles County and Washington State that have had an experience moving from paying for inputs to focusing on outcomes in their contracts. And now they want to embed that across the mental health services agency, which does about $1.5 billion in contracts every year, or Washington State, which is seeking to embed performance-driven principles and outcomes-oriented contracting across their new $1 billion every biennium agency for children, family, and family youth services, DCYF. So we're deeply excited about the possibility and the opportunity to move from very necessary and essential demonstration projects to showing that this could actually be a way for an agency or even a jurisdiction to change its relationship with communities and to change how taxpayer dollars meet the people. So that's the biggest, that's one thing. And then the second thing is we need to really go to the source of where a lot of this public funding originates, which is in Washington, D.C. And so another thing that we'll be focused on over the next 5 years is, all right, if we're seeking to change how government does business in this country, how can we partner with folks who originate these many funding streams and originate many of the rules and guidance around how that funding can be deployed in communities? How do we partner with them to help them understand what an outcomes orientation looks like? And how do we help them support, you know, financially and with additional guidance, those states, cities, and counties that are interested in testing out this approach and learning how they might disrupt the status quo of how their money meets the people. So those are two big things we'll be focused on to scale.
Really cool. I come from the world of national security. So in version 15 or in 15 years, I hope that you're able to get into the way that the Pentagon buys and procures goods and services, because as much as the social sector needs it, other parts of the government do as well, for sure.
Well, I think it's important to say that for the time being, we're focused on the trillion that is human services. So health, education, child welfare, housing. But there's a lot of opportunity to be thinking about how government purchases services in results-driven ways.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Couple of rapid fire questions, if you wouldn't mind. What are you currently reading? What are some things that you've read recently that you found interesting?
So I'm currently reading Lean Impact by Anne May Chang, and it's been fascinating for me, just as somebody living in San Francisco, to see how the principles of Lean Startup can be applied to the social sector. And I think Anne May does a really great job about
focusing on a process of iteration and learning and improvement, which I think is something that oftentimes we shy away from in government or even in the social sector. There's a overall, I think, pressure to have some perfectly evaluated solution, but Lean Impact is very much about a process of iteration and learning and improvement and feedback from constituents and community members. So I've really enjoyed reading that. And then another thing that I've been looking at, Living Cities, which is another organization in the social sector, has put out some really fantastic resources recently about procuring for city services in more equitable ways, and specifically ways that cities can embed principles of racial equity, as well as more of a training focus around minority and women-owned businesses to increase the supply of minority-owned business organizations in their work. And so I've been learning a lot about that and excited about the work that they're doing as well.
Awesome. Awesome. And where can listeners find you and Third Sector online?
Yeah. So our website is www.thirdsectorcap.org. We have, in addition to being on all of the traditional social medias of Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, we have a blog on our website, which is probably the best way to keep in touch with the latest of what we've been learning and what our communities have been up to at any given time. We're in about 20 communities or more across the country. And so it's an exciting way to see what we're learning, but also to engage with it. And we love folks who reach out to us via social media as well.
Awesome. Caroline from Third Sector, thanks so much for walking us through your work and your space. It's been fascinating.
Thank you, Brendan.
That does it for this episode of Super Cities. Before we go, some real talk. Cities feel broken, too expensive, too crowded, too chaotic. So we created Super Cities to elevate the people and trends moving cities forward. This movement is just getting started, so please rate, review, and subscribe to Super Cities and tag us using hashtag SuperCities. Your support really helps, and I'm thankful for it. This is Brendan Hart and Super Cities, signing off for now.